From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Jazz singer Suzanne Cloud used to sound a little bit like a broken record.
I had to postpone mammograms, postpone bone density tests, that postpone appointments with an endocrinologist, postpone appointments with a neurologist since I have peripheral neuropathy.
But right now, she's pretty pumped.
All right, I got 125 over 70 here. Swing your legs around. Let me check the other one.
The clock has wound down on signing up for Obamacare, so who's in and who's out?
It just sort of made my head spin to try to figure out these numbers.
I'm already broke, but come and try to take more money from me.
Also on the show, could scientists help prevent potholes?
One method is to add fibers that's going to increase the tensile strength.
And Skyping with your doctor, is it as cool and efficient as it sounds? First, the news from NPR. Hello, pothole. How do these craters come to be? It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse sits with doctors and patients to hear their stories and connect you to the latest science.
It wouldn't shock me if we hit 90 in April.
And we just kind of sat there for a couple seconds in silence, taking this in.
I thought, there has to be a better way to do this. You know, do this, all of this.
The only data that was with the specimen was Cretaceous of New Jersey.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
It is absolutely like playing Tetris.
Recognizing that the virus needed this.
These rumors would spread.
All required in relationship
with this
new body.
Hey, how are you? Sorry I'm running behind schedule.
On today's show, the clock wound down for enrolling in Obamacare, so who got health care and how? Also, the bottom of your shoe and why it relates to understanding the human experience and living with epilepsy. But first up, when was the last time you had a smooth ride anywhere? Here's my tiny audio diary of driving through Philadelphia yesterday.
Little pothole. Patched potholes. More patched potholes. Big pothole. Whoa.
What causes potholes and can they be prevented? Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
In just about every Philly neighborhood, drivers have had enough.
My California Prius is having a really tough time with these roads.
Society Hill resident Christina Dechter recently moved here from Los Angeles, where she says potholes don't plague the streets. In Philly, she confronts them close to home.
There's a pothole on 4th Street and Lombard that's actually two potholes kind of catty-corner to each other.
Dechter says it's nearly impossible to avoid getting a tire jammed in that one. She says she's even changed her route to avoid a particularly bad stretch of potholes. Those complaints are not news to researcher Leslie McCarthy.
People love to ask about the potholes, and I've heard that from family members, I've heard it from strangers that I meet, and that's why I think transportation and pavement engineering in particular is so exciting.
McCarthy's an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Villanova University. She says this year's been a perfect storm for pothole creation. Remember those warmish days we had that were sandwiched in between all that freezing, snowy weather? Well, Philadelphians enjoyed a nice long bike ride in the moderate temperatures. Inside the pavement beneath them, craters were being born.
Potholes are one of the tough cookies in terms of pavement damage. And the reason is it's purely environmental loading, what we call environmental loading phenomenon. So you have a series of freeze and thaw cycles that will cause these potholes to occur. And potholes are going to occur anywhere where there's an existing crack.
McCarthy says water slides in through those cracks and joints, and as temperatures plummet, it turns to ice. That takes up more space than liquid water, so the ice pushes out the pavement and breaks it. She says to repair the roadway, the pavement and the hole are heated up, and a toasty hot mix, that's hotter than 300 degrees Fahrenheit, is poured in. Standing in front of two-story brick front houses, the streets department's chief highway engineer, Steve Lorenz, watches a machine at work.
What we have is our pothole patch, or sometimes called the pothole killer machine.
It's a machine that the city of Philadelphia uses to fill potholes in a mechanical type manner.
The extended arm of the pothole filler works its way back and forth, shooting a spray into a pothole.
It'll spray air into the hole to clean out any loose debris or water. It'll then spray an emulsion into the hole that'll allow it the stone and the aggregate to stick to the hole. Then it'll spray some stone in, and within the stone it'll also have some of that emulsion fluid in there to stick it all together.
He explains that after the hole is filled, the truck and then regular traffic drives over it, packing down the stones and emulsion, a thin tar-like substance that allows the gravel to bond together into the sides and bottom of the pothole. This winter's been a beast for the Philadelphia area. The city expects to break a record this year with the number of potholes fixed. It's already topped 25,000 at a cost of about $22 each. So that means $550,000 to fix the holes. To prevent potholes from springing up in the first place, Villanova engineer Leslie McCarthy says road crews can seal up cracks in the road and provide good drainage when building roads. McCarthy says there are also national and state studies being done looking at new technology and how to prevent moisture damage, which is ultimately what causes potholes.
One method is to add fibers or other types of additives that's going to increase the tensile strength, meaning it's not the cracks aren't going to develop as easily, and therefore the water's not going to get in as easily.
McCarthy passes one such high tensile strength synthetic fiber across the table. The yellow pieces look like a doll's hair. McCarthy says new equipment is also being studied. For example, a tow-behind mobile system that uses infrared technology to heat up the pothole, then fill it with a hot patch. She says that sort of mobile system is faster and safer than crews manually doing the work.
We have a saying in highway construction, get in, get out, stay out. So this type of unit would help towards that end.
Technology is not the only thing that'll help improve the roads. Money helps, too. Officials at the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation say, thanks to the recent passage of the new transportation funding bill, PennDOT will be resurfacing more roads and fixing more bridges. For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
We're going to stay with the theme of rocky roads for the moment. The rollout of the Affordable Care Act has been rather bumpy.
I received the letter, my health coverage will be discontinued.
I got through that, and then it kind of went zzz.
It says, you know, invalid password.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems.
Healthcare.gov works great now.
As you just heard President Obama say, enrolling improved. The Pulse has been following several individuals throughout this process, and now that the main deadline has passed to sign up this year, we wanted to check in and see how is it working out. The Pulse's Alana Gordon found that persistence appears to be paying off for one determined jazz singer.
62-year-old Suzanne Cloud of Collingswood, New Jersey, is a musician and adjunct professor who wasted no time last fall logging on to healthcare.gov to try to find coverage. For years, she's had a routine when she had to see a doctor. The receptionist would first ask, "Do you have insurance?"
I'd say, no, I'm one of the 52 million Americans who don't have insurance.
She'd say it loud enough so everybody in the waiting room could hear her.
Some would clap, some would look at me like I was insane, and other people would just kind of, you know, smirk under their hand or something. It was funny, but I would do that no matter what doctor's office I was in.
Cloud was blunt because so many of her musician friends are too embarrassed to talk about their health, and they suffer. She's watched some die prematurely. And she's also held off on some of her own care, all due to cost. But on a recent visit to the doctor, she started a new routine with the receptionist.
Yes, I'm here. I have an appointment with Dr. Minari.
Dr. Minari, okay, you can go ahead and sign in for me, and I will be with you momentarily.
Okay, and I've got insurance.
All right, hang on to that for me.
Cloud flashes her new shiny insurance card across the counter. She's one of at least 3 million people nationwide who enrolled in Medicaid since the fall through the Affordable Care Act. She qualified because New Jersey expanded its eligibility guidelines, allowing low-income single adults to sign on. The process was confusing for all those technical reasons plaguing the system's rollout, but by mid-January, she was finally set.
Hello. Hey. How are you? So how are you?
I'm doing good. I guess you saw my lab.
Today,
test, right?
Cloud meets with her longtime doctor, Mary Minari. She's affiliated with Cooper. It's been about a year since they've seen each other.
What I'd like to see, what I want to do since I've got insurance now, is to get some appointments if you think I need it.
The two talk about how their medical decisions can change because of Cloud's new insurance. Cloud can access different medications now. Dr. Minari admits caring for Cloud when she didn't have coverage made her anxious.
You know, it's nerve-wracking because you know, there's certain risk of, you know, premature heart disease, strokes, et cetera. And, you know, you really want to make sure that you provide the best preventative care you can, especially for a diabetic. And to know, like, right off the bat that we're limited, it's nerve-wracking. All right, I got 125 over 70 here.
Well, that's more.
Swing your legs around. Let me check the other arm just for a bit.
Minari checks Cloud's blood pressure. She says she's in good shape. After their visit wraps up and Minari leaves the exam room, Cloud says she's surprised by what her doctor told her.
As a patient, you're always panicked anyway, you know. But until I heard her today, I didn't realize how much stress that must put on a doctor as well.
Cloud then walks out of the office with a stack of specialist referrals and prescriptions.
I'm feeling very happy. I'm ecstatic. You know, I got, it's really lifts an entire weight off my shoulders. I can't tell you.
Next, she's off to the hospital. But not for her. She's picking up a musician friend who recently suffered from a burst appendix. She's been bugging him, too, about getting health coverage. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Later on in the show, we'll hear from some other people who are trying to navigate the new system, some with less success than Cloud.
I'm already broke, but come and try to take more money from me.
So that's still to come. Also, they are on the bottom of your shoe, on your cell phone. Bah! Why should you collect them?
The idea there is to look at what we call biogeography, which is a fancy way of saying who lives where.
Creating a library of microbes. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. It's time now for a science news update, and joining us is Cary Grenz. She is an associate editor with The Scientist, and in her role there, she reviews lots of new studies every week, and she keeps us posted on what's happening. Her picks for this week, Saturn's moon, kids' stress, and Stradivarius violins. Hi, Cary.
Hi, Mike.
Let's start with one of the moons circling around Saturn. What's happening there?
So this particular moon that we're interested in this week is called Enceladus. It's quite small. It's only about 300 miles across in its diameter. It's covered in ice, and so it reflects all of the light that hits it. So it's really, really cold. But interestingly, beneath that icy crust is actually liquid water. Researchers are reporting that there's an area about the size of Lake Superior at the moon's south pole, and this ocean or lake is thought to be really, really deep, maybe even going through the center of the moon. Researchers realized this ocean was there because the gravity at the south pole is weaker than at other parts of the moon. So it has to compensate somehow with something more dense than ice, but not as dense as rock. And so we know that water sinks and ice cubes float. So the likely candidate for something more dense is liquid water. This also explains some previous observations that scientists had seen, which were plumes of water spewing out of the moon. And so it's likely that the water is coming from this buried ocean.
And how did researchers gain this insight? Is there a current space mission that is collecting this data?
Well, Cassini is doing flyby missions, and it has been for years. And so we're monitoring the speed of Cassini spacecraft as it's going by the moon. And so what they've observed are these very tiny accelerations and decelerations in Cassini that are indicative of this sort of uneven distribution of gravity around the moon.
So what makes this find so exciting, that there is water, albeit trapped under a sheet of ice?
Well, liquid water would be essential to life. And because there are other ingredients, such as sodium and potassium and methane on Enceladus, adding water to the mix makes for a very compelling reason to explore further if life could have possibly developed there.
All right, let's move on to the next study you wanted to highlight this week, which relates to stress and how it affects kids' genetics.
Right. So this study in particular has to do with chromosomes, which are the big bundles of DNA in our cells. And there are caps on the end of chromosomes called telomeres. And every time your cell divides, telomeres get shorter. It's just a normal part of aging. This study looked at 40 young boys, and some of them grew up in extremely stressful environments. Others grew up in very privileged environments. And what they found was that the telomeres of the children, by the time they were 9 years old, the kids in the more disadvantaged environments actually had much shorter telomeres than those who grew up in the stable households. What this means is that the kids from the stressful environments had telomeres that looked much older than the kids really are, than their cells really are.
And how does a short telomere affect us?
Well, as I said, it is a normal part of aging. Telomeres are thought to protect chromosomes, and as they get shorter and shorter, then you just have this sort of, they call it physiological weathering of the chromosome. And so it's not entirely clear then what the consequences of this observation are in these boys. And I will point out also that it was a small study, and this does not prove cause and effect. We're not proving that the environment is causing these changes in the telomeres. They're just correlated. But I think it does speak to the potential for this very profound influence that our environment can have on us, and the need to protect children from these very stressful environments.
Carrie, your last pick for this week involves violins, and not just any violin, but a Stradivarius.
Right. So violins made by Antonio Stradivari and his contemporaries are some of the most coveted instruments. They're made hundreds of years ago and are considered by many violinists to produce the most glorious sound. But of course, researchers want to test this scientifically. So they did kind of a blind violin taste test or sound test to see if professional soloists could actually tell the difference between these old instruments and newer violins. The way they did this was they had 10 soloists come to France to play a variety of violins. 6 were new and 6 were old Italian violins, including Stradivariuses. And the soloists wore goggles so they couldn't see which instrument they were playing. And then they picked their favorite violins. And you can probably guess where I'm going with this, right, Mike?
Right.
So the violinists tended to favor the new violins. And actually, the most popular violin among all the musicians turned out to be a new one. And The violinists were actually no better at figuring out which violins were old and which were new than if they had just flipped a coin.
Wow. I'm sure that didn't go over too well, huh?
I don't think that this devalues a Stradivarius or another old Italian violin. There's still something almost mythical about these instruments that makes the experience of playing one or listening to one so special. And I did read in one news report that, you know, Stradivariuses sell for millions of dollars and that there's really no indication at this point that the study is going to affect the value of the instruments.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you, Mikan.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist, and she joins us regularly on The Pulse. Microbes, you know, bacteria, fungi, they are everywhere. We've heard amazing figures recently about the human microbiome. That's the population of microbes that lives on us and in us. Current estimates suggest there are 10 times more microbial cells in our personal biome than actual cells of our own bodies, meaning we're outnumbered. Reporter Kimberly Haas recently learned about an effort to catalog this vast population of microbes on Earth. Her story starts at Philadelphia's Wells Fargo Center.
Kyrie Irving.
It's a Tuesday night matchup between the Philadelphia 76ers and the Cleveland Cavaliers. During a timeout, a sort of cannon is wheeled onto the court and begins blasting T-shirts out into the crowd. But on this night, rolled up in each shirt is a microbial sampling kit. It seems like a curious combination, a basic scientific research tool at a big city public stadium. But for the researchers at the Argonne National Laboratory in Chicago, it's the logical method for building the Earth microbiome map, to plot which microbes appear in which locations all over the Earth.
And we tried to collect samples from around 4,000 cell phones and shoes from people at these various events.
David Coyle is a research scientist at UC Davis who's working on the project.
The idea there is to look at what we call biogeography, which is a fancy way of saying who lives where. You know, what sort of microbes do we find on the feet of people at the San Antonio Spurs game versus the San Francisco 49ers versus sort of different areas of the country.
So why shoes and cell phones?
Shoes are interesting because they serve as sort of a microbial collection device. Everywhere you go, you pick up microbes, and then we can sort of just look at that by swabbing your shoe instead of having to, you know, crawl all over the neighborhood.
One clear part of the research has already shown that it's different on shoes than it is on cell phones.
That's Darlene Cavalier, founder of the citizen science website SciStarter. She's also the project director for this effort.
People are tracking their shoes all over the place. You would think that that would show a little bit more of a diversity in the microbial makeup. Most of the junk and the diversity is on your cell phone more than your shoe.
David Coyle thinks it's because our cell phones are in closer contact with the microbial soup that's in and on us.
The things we find on a cell phone are human-associated microbes. They're the things we normally find on skin and other surfaces that we're in contact with a lot.
It's a big project, yet the whole world, about 7 billion people, trillions of microbes on every one of us and everything we own. Each of the 4,000 samples might contain hundreds of microbes, but it still sounds like a raindrop in the ocean.
What that gives us is a snapshot. So it's 4,000 samples that maybe can start to develop a look at patterns, how microbes behave based on where they're found.
Once it's all compiled, the database will be a huge asset for scientists. For example, by better understanding the microbial population, researchers can refine our knowledge of ecosystems and how they function. But the project coordinators hope it'll be used by all kinds of people.
All of that data will be available on our website in an interactive format, so people will be able to actually explore the data themselves and ask questions like, how do microbes differ between football fans and baseball fans?
That 4,000 sample mark is in sight, with about 700 to go. There's a big push this month, including at the Philadelphia Science Festival, which begins on April 25th. For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
The The music we're listening to right now is called Microbial Bebop, by the way. And to see a video of people swabbing their sneakers and cell phones, check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Kimberly Haas will be back next week to talk about another part of this project. This one involves microbe swabbing here at our studios and sending the samples to the International Space Station. Two big words in healthcare right now: cut costs. And at a time when everyone is trying to do just that, it's no longer enough for doctors to treat someone who's sick. Another goal is to keep that person healthy. That means, at least for some patients, what happens in their homes or neighborhoods may be more important than anything that happens inside of the hospital. Case in point, Camden, New Jersey. Marketplace reporter Dan Gorenstein has this story.
We were all trying to breathe through our mouths.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Despite his obvious pain, 45-year-old Mariano Garcia sat transfixed, watching his podiatrist. Dr. David Malilli cut through the bandages wrapped around Garcia's left calf. It was one of those moments that takes forever. The smell filling the room.
Oh, God. Oh. Mm.
The dressings came off. The room went quiet. Then Garcia gagged, and Malilli threw up his hands.
I don't have access to treat this, right? I mean, he's created a gram-negative infection here. I don't see any maggots or anything, but I'm not down with this. When's the last time the bandages were changed?
Was last time I was here.
Really? A week.
Garcia's been coming to Cooper University Hospital in Camden, New Jersey for 2 years now, and everybody in the room knows what needs to happen. Those bandages must get changed. But no matter how simple it sounds, it's not happening. Garcia, who's on disability, says it hurts him too much to do it. Visiting nurses say they don't feel safe going to his neighborhood. Frustrated and defeated, Malilli has one choice right now, but he knows sending Garcia to the hospital is just a temporary fix.
When we finally get things turned in the right direction again, how do we keep it that way? That 3 weeks after he leaves the hospital, you know, why are we not in the same situation? I can't control infection, I can't control pain, and I can't control these wounds.
Of course, doctors have never had much control over their patients outside the four walls of the hospital, which has been good for business.
In some ways, this is a system that's financially benefited the most when we're at our sickest.
Rebecca Oney runs the nonprofit Health Leads, which works with medical providers to connect patients to social services. In this new era where hospitals either drive down costs or face stiff financial penalties, Oney says the loop patients like Garcia are stuck in is no longer lucrative. Really, this is the edge of the healthcare world.
They're going to have to begin paying for a set of things that have historically been considered outside the scope of traditional healthcare.
We're beginning to see healthcare's first hesitant steps where doctors and hospitals begin to explore their patients' social needs. Kaiser Permanente, one of the top health systems, has several pilot programs, including one in Oregon where ambulance staff act more like social workers, helping solve problems at home, avoiding trips to the ER. Even the nation's largest healthcare program for the poor, Medicaid, has signaled its willingness to pay for some care outside the traditional stuff, like air conditioners for asthmatics. Stephen Cha is Medicaid's top doc.
We recognize that it can't just be the office visit. That's the core of it. But we have to think about when we face a patient, we're looking at much more than just what we can do in that 15-minute span.
Yale public health professor Elizabeth Bradley says it's no mystery that education, poverty, and safety have more to do with a person's overall health than medical care. And that, she says, makes our country's decision to spend 55 cents on social services for every dollar we spend on medical care curious. In a recent book, Bradley and her co-author found European countries that flip that ratio are healthier than we are.
The major reason that we are not doing better, and really the unnamed culprit, is that we are probably spending less on the social services than is necessary.
On this new healthcare frontier, we aren't seeing insurers paying for job training or hospitals move families out of dangerous neighborhoods. But if the interventions save money, the game changes. Harvard health economist Amitabh Chandra, though, has his doubts. He says, sure, this work improves health, but you only save money if hospitals can pinpoint which patients truly benefit, a tall order.
I think of that as analogous to the manned mission to Mars. It's something that can be done. There's no theorem in economics or statistics that says it's not possible. But you need absolutely terrific data to be able to make that happen. And I've just never seen it.
Chandra's driving at the X factor, so often at the crux of healthcare. What makes someone change their behavior? Which brings us back to Mariano Garcia in Camden.
I didn't ask for this. You know, I wish I could get better and get all this clear and get me a job and work, you know?
Garcia's life is so precarious, his options are risky. Like if he lands a spot in some inpatient treatment program for his leg, he's not sure what happens to his one-room apartment.
I don't want to lose my place because I'm going to hospital. Then where I'm going to go at? To find an apartment here in Camden, man, it's like, it took me like a year just to get one apartment.
There's no easy answer, which is what makes waiting outside the world of medical care tricky. But hospital staff addressing Garcia's social needs has helped him keep appointments and even once or twice change his own bandages. For The Pulse, I'm Dan Gorenstein.
The Pulse has been following several people through the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, and now that the deadline has passed to sign up for this year, we wanted to see how are things working out. Alana Gordon checked back in with a woman who was initially on the fence about what plan to pick and whether she should pick one at all.
33-year-old Danielle Gatto of Philadelphia was diagnosed with Crohn's, an inflammatory bowel disease, in 2005. She learned this through a painful, unanticipated trip to the ER. She was uninsured.
The very first time that I went to the hospital with a Crohn's disease flare before I was diagnosed or knew what it was, I ended up racking up like a $40,000 bill.
Gatto, a restaurant manager and freelance video producer, says thankfully she got into a charity care program through the hospital. She did not want to be in that situation again, but found it nearly impossible to find private health coverage. Insurers kept rejecting her.
You know, it seemed that people who needed the health care the most were not able to get it, which just feels sort of absurd.
Gatto does now have what she describes as a very bare-boned plan. It doesn't cover her medicine, and it has a limited number of doctor's visits. So it didn't bother her when her insurer notified her the plan would be canceled this spring.
I wasn't too worried about it because I figured, well, no problem. I'm going to get a better insurance anyway through the marketplace.
But when she started looking for new options, she was overwhelmed by the choices and differences in coverage.
And the idea of kind of gambling and saying like, well, I don't think I'm going to get sick, but if I get this amount of sick, it'll cover that.
The biggest blow, a treatment she's put off for Crohn's, didn't appear to be covered. She thought about keeping her current coverage as long as possible. After a lot of back and forth, weighing premiums, deductibles, she recently settled on a plan. Hospital visits appear to be covered, regardless of whether she's admitted. But she's really worried about the fine print.
How is this actually going to work out? You know, what's going to happen? I mean, eventually I'm going to end up in the hospital. What's going to happen? Is it going to be covered?
Gatto says there is one lesson she's learned that gives her some comfort amid all this uncertainty.
From dealing with these health insurance things and this disease for so long, I now realize how many ways around things there are.
Gatto says getting needed care when there are gaps requires being savvy and persistent, finding discounts, negotiating how services are billed. Her new coverage kicks in later this spring. She says already she's initiating these kinds of conversations with providers. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up next on The Pulse, when it comes to communicating with doctors, wouldn't you love this? Instead of hearing this,
please listen to all of the options before making your selection.
A look at the benefits and pitfalls of modern communication in healthcare. That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Some boutique medical practices are offering Skype sessions and instant communication with doctors as a benefit and bonus to their clients for a price. And modern communication will likely eventually change how all of us communicate with our doctors. But some medical experts are concerned that it could be destructive to practicing good medicine. Sophie Reed has this look.
Technology dominates our work and home lives. Email, Facebook, there's no escaping it. From the moment we wake to the minute we fall asleep. And now technology could change how we talk to our doctors. One boutique startup in Philadelphia trying out this approach is Our Health. For a $79 monthly subscription, they offer family doctor services, plus some modern accessories. With Our Health, you can Skype or email your doctor from the comfort of your home or office. And although you have to buy a separate insurance policy to cover major costs, like an operation, it does sound pretty convenient. So I recently set up a Skype appointment with Dr. Stephen Stoll to test out how it works.
Sophie.
Dr. Stoll, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
It's really my sinuses, and I just wondered if that's something we could talk about over Skype.
Absolutely. There's many different things that can cause sinus infections. It could be viruses, allergies, or even bacteria.
What a relief to avoid the dreaded waiting room. So what kinds of problems might online doctoring work for? Dr. Randy Robinson, Chief Medical Officer at Our Health, says talking over a blood test or a diagnosis for something like shingles can all be done using Skype, and patients can still go in to see the doctor if they want to. The idea is to make life easier for everyone.
We're able to take technology that has evolved over time and use it in medical practice as a tool to deliver care rather than an obstacle in between the patient and provider.
There's little doubt that all this instant communication with your doctor is convenient, but it's a far cry from the cozy 1950s image of the family physician.
To doctors like Dr. John Wade of Ohio, USA, each patient is a personality, not merely a mechanism to be set to rights.
Those were the days. Dr. Victoria Sweet is an internist and professor of medicine at the University of California. She prefers the old-school style of medicine and says there's no substitute for real FaceTime with your doctor.
Skype, I'm a little more skeptical of because it's so easy to think that you can replace that really personal presence.
I asked Dr. Sweet whether being in the same room as a patient really makes a difference.
There's so much you get out of it. I mean, if I watch somebody just walk in, I smell them. You smell their clothes. You smell how clean they are, how dirty.
Dr. Sweet told me about one patient who was sent to her. He'd had every test imaginable, and still nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. But a simple physical exam gave Dr. Sweet the clues she needed to make a diagnosis.
It turned out he had esophageal cancer, metastatic. Nobody had felt these lumps. They had done all the blood tests. They'd sat in front of their computers, but they'd never looked at the man. It was right on his body. This happened over and over again.
A powerful message that hands-on doctoring through sight, smell, and touch could be the key to better healthcare. Dr. Sweet again.
A really good family practitioner, they're incredible.
they're so important in their patients' lives. You can't replace that. It's a relationship. And the essence of the matter is that relationship.
So how can we make sure that in a hectic world, gadgets don't distance us from our doctors? Concierge MD is a software company based in Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. It's helping doctors' clinics across America adopt web and smartphone technology into their practice. Chief Executive Vijay Khanna says online access to our doctors improves the patient experience.
They get to still see the physician. We are not taking away, we are enhancing that relationship, because now I can, in a more convenient way, email my doctor and schedule appointments and do everything else. So it's actually enhancing that relationship in so many better ways.
Instant access doesn't automatically equal quality care, but it sure would be nice to avoid this familiar scenario in the future.
Please listen to all of the options before making your selection. To make, change, or cancel an appointment, please press 2. For prescriptions or to speak with a nurse, press 3.
For The Pulse, I'm Sophie Reed.
Sticking with the subjects of health and technology for a moment, the number of digital health applications is exploding. Think all those strange bracelets people are wearing, stuff they have on their phone. We asked The Pulse's Tanya English to find out who's keeping tabs on all the options.
There's a growing number of on-the-go applications and handheld devices. Back in 2012, there were about 40,000 mobile health options.
The bad news is there isn't much direction on what to do with what is out there.
Drexel University professor Michelle Rogers teaches healthcare informatics. Rogers wishes health professionals would weigh in to say which applications they like and which they trust.
That is kind of murky right there.
Most mobile health applications are designed for the worried well. That's all of us out there trying to improve our health on our own. From Fitbit to Fuelband, those devices let you keep tabs on your steps or your calories, all in the name of wellness. Then there's a whole different set of mobile health tools. They're designed to help your doctor keep tabs on you.
The blood pressure monitor will now activate.
There are now at-home blood pressure monitors that take a reading automatically, then send that data directly to your doctor.
Your current blood pressure level may indicate mild hypertension.
We don't know that that's any better than if you were to do it yourself, write it in a little book that comes with the blood pressure cuff, and then when you go to the doctor, you take that book with you.
Rogers has lots of questions.
Does this heart rate app actually work?
And
will doctors ultimately use all this information that we're tracking?
So when does a mobile device become a mobile medical device? And when does the government step in to make sure that application is safe?
That's the key question. So far, what they've kind of said is that they're only going to test things that impact a direct health outcome.
There are about 100 of those that have actually received FDA review and approval.
Linda Fleischer is a researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She and others are studying digital health applications to make sure they're easy to navigate for people at different literacy levels or those who don't speak English well.
It's not just providing them, it's making sure that people can actually use them.
Michelle Rogers is looking for a new kind of collaboration.
Do we have the computer scientists working with the public health people, working with the doctors and nurses?
That's happening slowly, but Linda Fleischer says, buyer beware and do your research.
We need to make sure that from a consumer perspective side, we understand how it works and if it works and in what ways.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. In today's edition, we hear from Dan Dougherty. He remembers a specific day 32 years ago when his life changed, the first time he had a seizure. He was diagnosed with epilepsy, and that's an issue he's worked to educate people about. By the way, some of the music you're going to hear in this piece includes sounds that were converted from the brain waves of a person having a seizure.
The brain has electrical surges constantly happening. Once in a while, a spike would go real high. So that is what a seizure is. It's too much surge of electricity happening. So like in a house, you get an electrical surge and the symptom is lights go out. Same thing in the brain. That's what a seizure is, a short circuit in the brain. And then I've been having a lot of short circuits in my life. At the age of 10, I was diagnosed with epilepsy. So for 10 years, I was a pretty healthy boy, loved to play, loved to do things. One winter day, I was going sledding in the park, and I remember going down the hill, and it was more than just being dizzy. The world was spinning, and my first seizure occurred. I continue having seizures. The doctor says a very stubborn form of epilepsy. And it's always been, ever since then, a trial and error with medication. Different types of seizures, too, all through the years. In the 90s, I had a period of great mild seizures. People don't understand what they are. They are convulsions, the shaking, and they're very scary. And that was a long 10 years of that, and tiring. When I was younger, it really didn't change my daily life because I was young. My parents allowed me to play. When I got older, when people started beginning to drive, that's when it started to impact me because when seizures are not controlled, you're not able to drive. So that's impacted me on a negative way because it creates a social void. People are going out. I have to say no, and it's very heartbreaking. I inherited from my grandfather, I think, and my family, humor, and it's a good coping skill. Humor goes a long way with dealing with the seizures and changing with the medication constantly and go to the doctors and all that. It helps a lot. And there's about 2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living with epilepsy, which is greater than MS, cerebral palsy, and Parkinson's combined. And I think it's very important to get the word out and to put a positive face on it. It's nothing to be scared about.
Dan Dougherty educates people about living with epilepsy, and that kind of work is much needed, says Dennis DeLugos, a neurologist and epilepsy specialist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Because even though the disorder affects about 3% of Americans, there are plenty of misconceptions. For example, says DeLugos, people don't understand how complex epilepsy is.
Epilepsy is very much a medical disorder. It does, however, come with an increased chance of troubles with learning, behavior, social skills. And that very complicated mix is very difficult for patients, families, physicians, and the general public to understand without continuing the stigma of epilepsy that's existed for centuries.
Dennis DeLugos is an epilepsy specialist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Jeanette Woods produced this story. And if you have an idea for our series, Patient Files, please email us at thepulse@whyy.org. Pulse reporter Alana Gordon has been following the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, and today she's catching up with some of the people she met as they were trying to enroll. For the system to work, officials are banking on young, healthy people to sign up. Gordon checked in on a guy who might as well be a poster child for this effort, but he almost didn't sign up.
24-year-old Nathaniel Scott of Philadelphia doesn't make a lot of money, but he still sees the value in having health insurance. What if the unexpected happens and he needs emergency care?
And then after I get out, I get, a bill from the hospital for like thousands and thousands of dollars. And then my head's spinning saying, oh my goodness, how am I going to pay all this?
Scott lives with his younger sister in the house where they grew up. Just over a year ago, their mom died of an autoimmune disease. Scott says that furthered his desire to be responsible.
With everything falling on me, now being the head of household, there's other people that I have to think about, not just myself.
Scott works in IT, but his employment situation has been tenuous. Promising full-time work fell through when the sequester hit last year. So in November, he looked into his health insurance options through the marketplace.
Yeah, they're still processing a few things.
Scott pulls out several invoices. He, too, fell in a technical labyrinth of lost applications and mistakes. He finally figured most of it out by December and selected a slimmed-down plan available to young people because it was the cheapest. But he then realized he'd still have to pay a lot out of pocket first before any coverage kicked in.
To be honest, I'm still as confused today as I was when I first started enrollment back in early November.
He debated dropping the coverage. Confusing matters more, he got some contract IT work in January. That increased his eligibility for insurance discounts through the marketplace.
So that's definitely a positive.
Less positive, his sister lost her previous health coverage. Scott sought help to see if he could put her on his plan, but it was too expensive. For people like Scott, who experience so-called life-changing events like a new job, he can apply for more time to sign up for coverage this year. But at this point, he's tired of dealing with it. He'll keep his $200 a month plan.
I wish it were lower, but it's nice to have it than to not have it.
Scott's keeping his fingers crossed he'll get more work, and in the meantime, is trying to help out his sister as much as he can. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.